Hello, fellow foodies. They say that the best things in life are free. And what better way to enjoy food than to find free, healthy food growing in the wild in your own neighborhood? In this episode, I'll be speaking with Atlanta's own Johnny Appleseed, forager and forester Robbie Astrove, who is absolutely passionate about making fruit accessible to people in urban centers by planting more fruit trees. Robbie is an arborist, an environmental educator, and consultant in Atlanta, Georgia, who has worked on behalf of nature and people for over 15 years. He manages the 2,500-acre Arabia Mountain Nature Preserve in Stonecrest, Georgia, and specializes in native plants, edible landscaping, and in connecting people to nature. He also connects people to nature through the fruit that he forages and that he shares with chefs, mixologists, medicine makers, and community groups. He volunteers with Concrete Jungle, an organization that donates foraged and grown food to shelters, food banks, and instructs workshops on tree ID, planting, and pruning. During the winter months, Robbie plants fruit trees, berry bushes, and herbs to support urban biodiversity and access to healthy, fresh, and affordable food in communities with limited food access. I'm also going to be speaking with Chris Wilkins of The Root Baking Company, which is a wholesale bread bakery that he founded along with his wife Nicole in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. They moved the business to Atlanta in 2018. And Root Baking Company is a southern bakery and cafe specializing in European-style hearth breads, simple pastries, and vegetable-forward food, sourcing grains and ingredients from the southeast. So Robbie and Chris have actually been collaborating on some really exciting wild food projects, and we're going to dive into some of their recent work that they've done together. So thanks so much, guys, for coming on the show. It's awesome to have you here. And I see you brought some goodies. There's some twigs on the table, and also a couple of interesting bottles we might tap into later.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. This is great.
Yeah. So I thought it would be fun to start off the conversation around food foraging and especially wild fruit foraging. And maybe, Robbie, you can start by giving us a little bit of background on what does that entail?
So foraging is something that's really fun. It's my passion. I'm an ecologist by training, so I've had this strong relationship with plants. Particularly native plants for beautifying the neighborhood and for wildlife. And at some point, you just want to ask the question, what is this good for?
Yeah.
Besides all the cool ecology stuff. And it involves celebrating through food and medicine and other products. And just slowly started building a knowledge base and spending time outside.
Yeah. So how does one get started in foraging? Is it safe to do? Like, how do you distinguish between plants that are safe to eat and those that, you know, will knock you over?
I can't stress this enough that folks need to do their homework and to make sure they're getting what they think they're getting. Also really important to the conversation is having ethics be a part of foraging. You don't want to clear a place out. You want to leave it for other people and other wildlife and animals and, of course, not do any harm to an area.
Yeah.
Particularly, you don't want to take anything rare and endangered, of course, as well.
And that's part of the hallmark of knowing which plants, you know, aren't endangered or threatened. That's
Absolutely.
Great. That's great. Well, I'm really curious to know how the two of you met and how you started collaborating together, because I think the ties between those of us that are connected to the food through foraging or growing and then those that actually deliver food to the table through different culinary innovations is really a unique marriage and expertise and insight. So how did you guys meet and how did this all get started?
We met at the East Atlanta Village Farmers Market. Which is where you meet all kinds of crazy folks, but especially, you know, folks who are interested and invested. You can tell I'm, like, clearly not from the Southeast, but it was 10 seconds of talking to me. So you meet folks who are interested and invested in, you know, local agriculture or foraging or just, like, kind of do-gooders. And so, like, I can't stress enough, though, like you said earlier, like, part of the foraging was one side of it. The other part of it is getting it to people to eat.
Yeah,
and that's my whole job, of course. But like, you need folks who are able to find these flavors and then like say, hey, this is good, and then we say that is good, and we find ways to use it that are sort of familiar to people that they can try those flavors in sort of new but also familiar ways.
So, what are some of your favorite things to forage around Atlanta, and how are those getting integrated into local dishes?
So you know, when people talk about foraging, one of the first things that come up or people think about is actually mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really do a lot of mushrooms. There's plenty of folks in that lane. And, again, my love is with plants.
Mm-hmm. And, two different kingdoms, right?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And I tend to specialize in small fruits and berries, a few nuts, edible flowers, and herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I want to return to something that Chris touched upon for a second. You know, just because I plant all this fruit around the city doesn't mean that people are going to eat it. And I'm very purposeful in planting and food access, you know, where there's not a lot of access to fresh, healthy, affordable food.
In food deserts, basically, where you have limited access to fresh fruits and vegetables. Yeah.
That's right. So whether it's working with a baker or a mixologist or a chef, or now we're actually working with cooks at shelters, that people are now getting it prepared in a really loving and awesome way.
Mm.
And as much as I love to share all this food fresh, and like, trust me, service berries are amazing fresh.
Mm-hmm.
It takes sometimes a really talented baker like Chris to reinvent it in a way that we've never experienced. We need dehydrated some. We'll talk about later.
Yeah.
And it was just super delicious and refreshing and new. And I think as a culture and society, sometimes we need something new to remind us about something from the past.
Yeah.
So we're talking about indigenous food here.
That's a really good point. Yeah. So these would have been consumed for quite some time. There are some native species of we're talking today a lot about serviceberry, which is in the rose family. And there are native species here that have been consumed for a long time. So these are actually like little bitty apples in a way. They're pomes. What do they taste like?
So I would compare them to a blueberry to start with, both in size and color, and also taste. They're very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
They have a small seed that you can chew. It's very almond-like,
mm-hmm.
the flavors described. The name, there's several names for serviceberry. There's Juneberry, which is indicating the month that the fruit is ready.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the other names reference the spring flower, like Shadbush or Saskatoon or Sarvisberry. And Shadbush is named from when the shad are running. So
the shad are kind of fish.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, going back to history, and Pete, that was really important. You knew when that happened. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting how plant names correspond with like seasonal indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And another name, Serviceberry, came from, well, there's two different sayings. One was when there were a lot of folks dead from WW1. They needed to bury the troops, and they needed a signal or a sign to know that the ground had been thawed.
Okay.
So it was the blooming of the flower in springtime, which indicated that it was ready.
So it's like a funeral indicator of, like, now the ground's ready. Wow, that's fascinating. I didn't know that.
Also, the Native Americans used the bloom to indicate when it was time to plant your corn.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And so the scientific name of this, we know it's in the rose family, and we were talking about this earlier, is the pronunciation.
Yeah.
How do you like to pronounce it?
It's Amelanchier.
Amelanchier. And then some call it Amelanchier, but regardless, that's the genus. And there are a number of different species, including Arborea, which is the wild species we find here in the forest. But there are a number of others, cultivars, that are planted in gardens. And a lot of these are producing really tasty edible fruits.
They are. The
that's
one
great.
That I like a lot is Grandifolia.
Uh-huh.
And it's a cross hybrid. Of course, for bigger flowers and bigger, tastier berries.
Nice, 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 nice. So continuing on with this line of serviceberry, I'm curious, Chris, how did you take this wild fruit and transform it into this delightful baked good?
So to kind of finish like our origin story a little bit, it's like that's Robbie came up to me at the market. We had built this relationship where we kind of knew what each other did, and we, you know, shared a set of values about sourcing and just, I think, general flavors and quality, because we like to keep our flavors like rooted where we are.
Mm-hmm.
But we are, I bake fancy crusty breads and, you know, croissants and stuff like that. So in that kind of vessel, we smuggle these like really cool southern flavors. And so Robbie had told me about the service berry. He said, have you ever had one? I was like, I've never heard of a service berry. I'm from upstate New York, and service berry is something I've never seen in my life. And so I tried it. I was like, it's a knockout, right? And so Robbie came up to the restaurant, and what, like 10 pounds of them or something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 10 pounds of service berries was like a lot of service
berries. That's a lot of service berries. Yeah. All fresh, too. Wow. Yeah.
And like the fun and challenging thing about, and this is like the best thing to teach young cooks and bakers and whoever is interested in sourcing, is like a lot of them came with the little stems still on them.
Uh-huh.
Those have to be removed.
And oh.
So,
it's a rite of passage.
It's a rite of passage.
It's like a lot of things to pluck off. Okay.
Yeah, right. So it's like, and it's almost like there's like, it's something you keep in the kitchen. It's like when everyone, and anytime someone has like 5 or 10 minutes, they'll just like do some, it's like meditative that way.
Yeah. Know? Okay.
But also, it's the scut work for the, and so anyway, but it had to be done. So anyway, we got them kind of processed that way and washed them and everything else. And then we're like, these are incredible, but like they're like right on the edge of like turning into like something we can't really use in a baking application. Like, you know, as bakers, it's one thing to put stuff on a plate,
mm-hmm.
But your turnaround on that's like gotta be pretty fast, and it's almost not worth it for Robbie to show up for like the amount that would just like go on a plate,
make a streak
or some fancy sauce out of it, right? And so by buying a lot, we're like, okay, we got to figure out something to do with these, and so we have a dehydrator, like a lot of kitchens do. So we thought, well, we'll dehydrate them, maybe we'll do like blueberry kind of powder, and so sure enough, we did, and it's delicious. It's like concentrated service berries.
So is it very sweet, tangy? What are the flavor profiles like?
A little. It's like it's really sweet because like those were very ripe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got like a tinge of like just like a really pleasant bitterness to it. That's like not, you know, not unpleasant at all,
mm-hmm.
on the palate, in my opinion. And so like it just tastes like a really good blueberry, honestly.
Nice.
And so dehydrator just it's I don't know, quite potent.
I thought it was genius because I think you captured it beautifully. It's a challenge and a welcome to get all this and have to figure out what to do with it. And so many times mixologists and chefs, makers, they turn to some form of preservation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's really important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Preservation, like figuring out how to stretch these ingredients to get like the most out of it. Cause I mean, the thing is too, is like, this is a very, so this is like, that was like it for that season, right? I think is what you said.
Yeah. So get it now? Or
yeah, right.
It's so a very seasonal, seasonal item for the menu.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful, but it's almost too fast for anyone to really appreciate it, because by the time like someone's mm-hmm. heard about it and they show up, like, oh, they feel really disappointed that, you know, it's not something like, it's not a row crop like corn or rice or wheat or something like that, where it's like we can stretch that pretty good because we buy it by the acre.
Yeah.
This is literally someone's gone out and like foraged this for us,
so,
you know?
So like, you talked about like plucking off the little green stems. How hard is it to actually forage it from the tree itself? Are you able to just kind of grab handfuls, or do you have to pick them off one by one?
I have a trade secret.
Okay.
It can take a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I did 300 pounds last year.
300 pounds. That's impressive. This has got me thinking of my husband's from Italy, and like his family has like their little plot of land with olive trees. And I remember they have two ways that they go after their olives. One is like you can kind of put a net under the tree, and you kind of have these fork hand things that, you know, you kind of scrape at the tree and then they all fall down. But I don't think something like that would be as useful for something as fragile as these service berries. Like, so you have a really nice trade secret, I bet.
Well, just like, you know, when you talk to any farmer or agriculturalist, they're with the food every day. They're trying it early. They're trying it when it's ready. They're trying it mm-hmm. when it's a little late. And so I've done the same thing with like a lot of the things that I forage. And in some of the chefs, for example, with plums, they want them green so they could pickle them. So I've gotten to explore phenology and fruit and like in my own way as a forager, and of course you get to try it all the time.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And
you're always in a race against the birds too and the other animals that are eating these as well, right?
Yeah, it's funny because perhaps one of my favorite birds is cedar waxwings.
And
I go to war with them every year. Usually it's like cedar waxwings like 3, Robbie, 0.
So it's a very, very important plant for their for them as well.
I want them
to have it. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's part of sharing, of leaving some of it behind for not just other foragers, but also for the forest creatures. That,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to go back to this evolving recipe. So now you have
right.
all these dehydrated. Are they? Are you powdering or grinding
yeah,
them
so
up?
Once they dry out, we're like, okay, what do we do? And so we have this process that we had learned from a chef friend of ours. What we do is sweet corn. We kind of do the same thing. We like dry it out. We, when it's in season, we, you know, shuck it, take the kernels, dry them out, and process to a powder. And it's like, it tastes like a little bit like Captain Crunch. I hate to say that. It sounds like it's a lot of work for Captain Crunch. but that's what we do. And that goes into a different thing. So we kind of, you know, copied and pasted that same process onto the service berries. And so we have, like, right now we have, like, basically, to continue the Captain Crunch metaphor, crunch berries, right? And so, like, we're like, all right, well, this is a really, really potent blueberry. We need something to kind of, like, it's also, like, got this, like, a little bit of a bitterness to it, which is not unpleasant, but still, like, needs to be balanced in some way. And so, like, we thought about it for a while, and, like, well, we need something kind of rich.
Mm-hmm.
And so the richest cookie I can think of is a Madeleine. It's just like this super buttery, you know, it's a butter bomb. But it's
nice.
It doesn't eat like a bomb, but it's just a ton of butter in a cookie. It's a little, you know, cake that everyone knows that Priestline about, but no one's probably actually ever read, including me. You know, it's like where he eats his Madeleine, he gets transported back in time. And, you know,
you've
seen the movie Ratatouille.
Oh, is that what happens to Ratatouille?
Yeah,
okay,
it's from,
nice.
It's from this Proust book that no one's read, but everyone cites in food. And so, like, so it's a great cookie, and it's super rich, and it balances out a service berry in a really nice way. So we did them, and, like, these cookies come out really beautiful and speckled because the service berry powder is, like, just shows up in the cookie as, like, this. It looks like a little blueberry cookie.
Hmm.
The interesting thing, though, is, like, selling them is a whole different story than, like, because people like you are like, yes, service berries in.
So you've got this beautiful product,
right,
and you're
right.
Like, oh, wait, now the audience or your customers
no
are like, what is that?
What a service berry is.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a lot of education.
Uh-huh.
Because if you call it service berry Madeleine, first of all, like, what is a service berry? What is a Madeleine sometimes?
Yeah.
Why is it $3.50? $4.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
It's a little cookie. Like, what is wrong with you? This is a small cookie for this much money. Anyway, so the interesting part that we go through, I think, is, like, so we are, like, very, very dedicated in sourcing these kinds of things, and, like, figuring out how to do something with them is one part of it. And the other part of it that I always forget about is, like, how do I sell this to people who have no idea what any of these things are, and get them to kind of buy into it. And, like, the best thing we can do is, like, here, eat it, right?
Yeah, try it.
But that's, like, I'm kind of interested in what your thoughts on this are, but how do you get people to try flavors that they have no real connection to? But it tastes like a blueberry, right?
Yeah,
but, like,
yeah.
They don't know that.
I think there's this intrinsic fear with new things. When it comes to new foods, it's just part of being human, is we're trained from a young age that these are the things we eat, and then it's always harder to adopt new flavors, which is why I think being a forager and kind of food explorer is always, like, they're the outliers, right? Because they're really pushing the boundaries of trying things. But this is a historic food. It was used in the indigenous diet. So it's not that it's a new food to humans at all. It's just a forgotten food.
Yeah. It's hard to remind people of that sometimes. Though. It's like, this is like, also, you know, Robbie can do an incredible job selling a service berry because, like, he's this person who's foraging it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for us, like, we know what he went through to do this stuff. We have a lot of respect for it, and we have to channel that vision into, like, this is why this is worth $3.75.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so I think that's like, it's really important to educate people on that without being preachy, because the hardest thing to do, frankly, on my end of things, is to sell something as it's good for you. Like, no one wants that. Like, nobody. Like,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
10 out of 10 people, when offered a handful of something that's good for them or a handful of something that's delicious, will take the delicious.
The
thing.
Delicious, yeah.
Right. And so, like, it is, like, incumbent upon us for those folks who work in, like, a making food with locally foraged or grown space, we have to figure out that it can't just be good for you or have a great story. It has to be delicious. And if the flavor isn't there, it won't sell.
Yeah. And accessible. I think this is something that's so interesting about living in Atlanta. I think there's a lot of really unique opportunities here because there's so many organizations that are dedicated to like tackling the problems of urban kind of food insecurity and food deserts. And I know, Rob, you've been involved in a lot of these. I don't know if you can talk a little bit about the work being done by organizations like Concrete Jungle or Trees Atlanta. I send students out to volunteer with these groups, and they go on plant walks. And, you know, it's always amazing when they come back, like, oh, wow, I didn't realize there are all these things on the Beltline that are, like, edible or that have a history in medicine. Or, you know, we kind of walk around without really seeing the natural world because, you know, we just don't have that background. So what can we do to better educate people? What have you seen has been successful?
Yeah, I think there's so much there with what you just said. And folks should know that while we could romanticize about the forest being this incredible provider of products and food, you know, we're in Atlanta in the middle of the city, and this is where I'm doing the foraging.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right in front of people. And something you said, Chris, you know, made me think, when I'm actually out harvesting service berries, I mean, I'm getting so much of their time. People are like, got their windows down, like, what are you doing? Like, beep, beep. And I run out with a handful. And I mean, I know the light's going to turn green, so I just say, eat this. Yeah. And they're like, what the hell is that? And I say, just trust me and have some, please.
Trust me, the stranger.
You look incredibly trustworthy, too.
You know, I have like 3 seconds. I'm like, oh, it's like a blueberry. Just try one. If you like it, you want more. And so, yeah, that education and unfamiliarity, it's a huge thing. And I think the fact that a lot of this is happening in the city and it's in front of people is helping. So real quick, shout out to Trees Atlanta.
Yeah.
Also my former employer. Because they have, I don't want to say single-handedly, but very much so, have provided a lot of the urban service berries in the city. Because it makes a wonderful, beautiful landscape plant.
Mm-hmm.
We call it three-season tree. Great flower, awesome berry. Dynamite fall color.
Nice.
Does, about it.
Great is this one of the trees that happens to be in the annual fruit tree sales that are held?
Yes.
Yes.
This weekend.
Oh, I missed it. I want some service berry for my yard. Okay.
Oh, I got you.
You got me. Okay, good, good. That's great.
And so, yeah, just, you know, there's a lot of this action is happening in the city. And there's fruit trees that are already on the landscape. And it's kind of how Concrete Jungle was born, just with this notice that there's a lot of fruit just laying on the ground. And we asked ourselves, that is a problem and why, and what could we do to repurpose this food? So Concrete Jungle, Atlanta-based nonprofit that is foraging and growing food that would, in creative and fun ways, that would go to homeless shelters, food banks, shelters.
Yeah.
Turning the waste into something.
Because a lot of food that's donated to these shelters is typically canned or highly processed, high in fats, high in salts, sugars. It's not like really nutritious food that goes to a lot of populations that really need access to fresh vegetables and fruits. I know that Concrete Jungle, some of the biggest crops that they collect every year are pears. Is that right? There are pears all throughout the city, figs. I don't know if they collect the mulberries, but there are many parks in town that have, you know, beautiful mulberry trees. Yeah. It's always interesting when you encourage somebody to taste something directly from a tree for the first time. I've done this before with my students, and they're always so hesitant, like, am I going to die from eating this? We're so separated from it. We're used to getting our apples, you know, from a bin in the store, and we're not used to going out and actually collecting them, harvesting them from a tree. It's such a novel experience, I think, for so many people today because we're so separated from where even our cultivated crops are coming from, not just the wild foods.
It's true. And, you know, I've been an environmental educator for almost 20 years and, you know, a naturalist and into the woods and, you know, ecology. And my mission is connecting people to nature.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 10 years, I've been able to do that, I don't say in a more meaningful way, but when you put something delicious in your mouth,
yeah,
you're getting connected to the source. And the one thing I love about foraging, too, is it not only gets us better connected, but this idea of, like, the changing seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe trying new things. And just paying attention to what the hell's out there.
Yeah. I think eating with the seasons is so important. I've interviewed Chef Satterfield before, and he's got this great book on eating through the seasons and really paying attention to that. And in my classes, I also talk a lot about plant chemistry and how it impacts the final flavor. And I mean, you as a chef will know this well. If you have a vine-ripened tomato versus one that's been, you know, collected in another country and shipped when green and then gassed, the flavor profile is totally different because the chemistry is different of that plant, and that's what impacts the flavor and the health benefits. So when you're harvesting these wild foods that are ripe or at the peak maturity, you're going to get more of a health benefit.
The other thing is I find, and this, you brought up Steven, which is a good, mm-hmm. like the best comp I think in town for how to eat with seasons in Atlanta especially, but like one thing that we find on our end too that's really, really interesting is that people get really tired of a season before the season's done.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
So like people are just done with okra before okra's done producing. And so like it's fascinating how often we'll hear – it's still there, and we're like, yeah, for like another 2 months, like or something
yeah.
like that. Or it's something like okra or peaches, or peaches is a little bit different. Like people never get really tired of peaches, I guess. But I don't know, maybe they do. But it's there are certain things that people just get; they just cannot look at another squash. Or I know.
Who are these haters?
I know. No, it's you'd be shocked at like.
Yeah. Do you think it's because they just don't know how to prepare it in different ways?
They're just tired of the weather. They want it to change. Part of it has got to be that. And the other part of it might just be the preparation thing, which is why we rely so much on every different kind of preparation. But because we rely on all these preparations, like with okra, we pickle it, saute it, fry it, you know, make it into ice cream, make it into all these things. And people are just like, stop. Stop. No more okra. Like, I don't want – give me anything else except this right now. And because we're trying to make the most use out of the ingredient in the season that it's in, people just get really tired of it, which is fascinating. And so there has to be some sort of like – this is just what there is right now. Because there is sort of like a problem of abundance that they can at any time not choose to eat in season.
Yeah.
There's always that out. You know what I mean?
I think there's this very, I don't know how to phrase this quite correctly, but because of so much abundance, we have so many opportunities for food waste. And actually, the next episode I'm taping is on food waste. And I think that's a great example. It's like, you know, but I think there are also other ways that we can store things for later use. I've become a total fermentation junkie. Like I'm lacto-fermenting all kinds of weird things in my house right now. Drying, as you mentioned, or freezing. There are definitely ways to store back foods in a healthy way.
Mm-hmm. There certainly are. And I think like, you know, yeah, in a professional food environment, like we have every kind of like preservation thing available to us, whether it be lacto fermentation or pickling or you know drying or whatever it's going to be, vac sealing, you know, low oxygen storing, whatever, I guess what they call it. And that is interesting enough where we find people just getting tired of stuff. We want to celebrate whatever's in season right now, and people are really into it for like 3 or 4 weeks, and then they're like, I can't look at this again. Like, time to move on, right? And it's that has like actually changed in my career, and also like in places that I've lived, where folks are just like kind of ready for the next thing, which is fascinating.
That's interesting.
It is interesting, and I think foraging is almost like the counter to that because it's shorter season. It's like the betweeners almost, and maybe it's because we're dealing with wild food and not. You know, when we plant radishes, we'll do like 3 different successions of radishes to keep it around because we love them, right? And foraging forces us to live by Mother Nature's clock.
Yeah,
and it's like celebrate it while you got it.
People love that though. Like this, the service bear thing. People were like flipping out about, and then all of a sudden it was a month later, and we're just out, and that was it.
You're like, where is it?
Where is it? And we're like, darn no more. Like, wait till next year.
Or when Chris had this photo shoot, he's like, hey, can you bring back some service berries? I'm like, dude, that was like 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And I had to raid my personal stash in the freezer.
Ah, so you had some frozen. See? There you go. So right. Really pretty, nice. Nice.
Yeah, they made the pages.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So this Madeleine that she produced, was it completely kind of purple like a blueberry, or was
it
kind of speckled?
Like speckled.
Oh,
it was
man.
A speckly.
That sounds amazing.
Speckly, speckly cookie. And like, so the other thing we do is like, we are very invested in local row crops, whether they be wheat or rice or corn. Especially, we're also like our thing is heirlooms. We started in Charleston, South Carolina, and it's kind of in the air down there that mm-hmm. like you have Anson Mills and you have all these like kind of legendary farmers in the low country. So we kind of came out of that into Atlanta. And the thing I love about Atlanta is like there's this kind of like foraging spirit here that mm-hmm. in Charleston, I'm not gonna say it doesn't exist, it does, in a little bit different way. You know, here it is very much more geared toward like what is this growing in the city. In Charleston, like they're kind of going off from the woods and finding stuff, which is great too, but it's just a different place.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think is unique about what Robbie does is like there's this stuff happening, like you can drive down the road and see edible fruit right there.
Yeah.
And Robbie does a great job. And Robbie and all the nonprofits we're talking about make us aware of these things in a way that I was not aware of in Charleston, even though that's like these epicenter for like southern heirloom grains. For example, like Sean Brock comes out of there and he's like, this is like the heirloom chef guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hanson Mills comes out of that. That's like the heirloom grain thing. And that's like all low country centric. But there's other cool heirlooms happening all over the South that people like Robbie are doing that we're not get a little less press. And this is great.
Well, I think it's key not only being able to find those or grow these heirlooms or find the wild forage foods, but also transforming them into something that's delicious, because in the end, that's what people want, something delicious. And
well, also, yeah. Also, like puts it explaining to like a Bon Appetit writer in New York, like what a service berry is a pretty fascinating experience. Cause like I was once that person who had no idea what a service berry was. Like,
yeah.
That sounds like a better blueberry. And like, yeah, I know it is a better blueberry. Right. And that's like, then all of a sudden like a service berry becomes something that, someone knows something about.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's the whole the whole point of this relationship, like beyond friendship obviously, is like we can find these things and put them on a pedestal and celebrate them, and they're so ephemeral that if we you know, lightning strikes, we can figure something out, we can make something really, really cool and also spread the good word a little bit.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. And from a botany perspective, the connection to the blueberry is so interesting too, because they're actually two completely different botanical families.
Yeah.
You have like blueberries and cranberries are in the Ericaceae family. Sorry, I'm geeking out over my botany now, and then you know service berries is in the rose family. So it's a relative of the apple and the plum and the almond, and you know, but because of the similarities, I think in color, you've got a lot of those really health benefiting anthocyanins that produce antioxidant, anti-inflammatory properties in the body that you find in both of those that makes them both really special.
I should like call you before I sell any.
Yeah,
fruit
I totally. Yeah,
I can say,
yeah.
It's anti-inflammatory. It's fine. you can buy as many cookies as you want. It's anti-inflammatory.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, I guess the anti-inflammatory to butter ratio has to be considered.
That doesn't matter. We don't need to talk about that. But what matters is
anti-inflammatory. So, thinking about future projects, I mean, have you been brainstorming? I don't know if you can share if you've been brainstorming on any kind of other cool wild foods that you'd love to elevate. Have you thought at all about persimmons or mulberries or some of these others that we find here in Atlanta?
So every year I always challenge myself to find one new species or item, and it's something that I've either known about for a long time but just never did it, or I'll take requests from chefs.
Mm-hmm. Like
the guys over at Staple House, they actually wanted me to harvest some pine resin.
Oh,
I was like, okay, let me start looking. I never thought about that, but you know,
Staple House.
Yeah,
awesome. Of course they would. That's awesome.
I mean, that's why I love these relationships, because I'm going to ask, well, what are you guys going to do with this? Because I have no idea what could be done, and then mm-hmm. I'll ask them, like, well, what do you want that's out there? Like, push me to new limits, just like I'm pushing you. And you know, one of the best compliments I ever got. You know, there's a lot of husband-wife teams out there, so the wife's writing the check. And she said, thank you for inspiring my husband to cook new ingredients.
That's great.
And I was like, that's the best thing I ever heard.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's so awesome.
But as far as like something new, I'm always trying to elevate our native species.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so there's, you know, pawpaws and American persimmon, service mm-hmm. berries, and aronia is coming up. It's mm-hmm. a new cultivar. It's supposed to be a little less astringent.
Nice.
But the one I have my eyes on, and I might have to go a little out of town. I don't know if we can call it local, but some mayhaws.
Oh, mayhaws.
South Georgia.
Uh-huh.
But I've also been planting a few around town. They need a few more years.
Yeah,
to kind of come into fruit. There's a few orchards I've been mixing them in. Mm-hmm. So the beautiful thing for me is projects and orchards that I planted like 10 years ago, they've been bearing fruit.
That's amazing. And the mayhaw, if I'm remembering correctly, is also in the rose family. I think it's Crataegus. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah.
Hawthorn.
Yes. You know, I actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I foraged some of that when I was doing work down in Baker County in South Georgia collecting plants. They also had some like awesome wild plums we foraged, and we got chanterelles. We had a whole forage feast with the students. It was pretty awesome. Yeah, really delicious. So let's talk a bit about this work that you're doing also in planting trees. So there are wild foraged foods and fruits that you can go out into the forest to acquire. But then you're also really active in bringing more fruit trees throughout the community. And so what does that involve? How hard is it to plant a fruit tree that can do well? And do you have recommendations of native fruit-bearing plants that people in this part of the South might want to consider in their yards? And when I say people, I mean me. I need some free horticultural advice here.
Yes. From the words, from the mouth of a tree planter, always plant something.
Yeah.
There's so many reasons, whether it be for climate change or beautification or for food. I'm a tree planter. I arrived to Atlanta with that skill set. I started working at Trees Atlanta immediately. And I'll kind of give you the origin story real quick, how I got into it. But, you know, we were doing the Trees Atlanta bread and butter, which is large canopy trees. And I was in the historic West End neighborhood. Getting ready for the project, and this gentleman came up to me, and he was super grateful. He was like, "My brother, thank you so much for what you're doing. This is great, but when you come back, plant some fruit trees, because mm-hmm. we're hungry here." And it was the first time I really considered just doing all fruit trees, and I just made a promise that I would do that. The next year I came back, I planted about 30, 40 service berries.
Wow.
Down the street, Lucille Ave, right on the Beltline.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of put me on this journey to look more at opportunities to do fruit tree planting. And the thing I had to work out is I was kind of paying attention to the agriculture community and the gardeners and farmers, and they're sun seekers. And as a tree planter, I was a shade maker.
Ah.
And that was kind of a conflict.
Okay.
And when I arrived at fruit trees, it was like everyone wins.
Yeah, nice.
And it was wide open in 2008 or 9. Like, no one was doing fruit tree work in the city. And I was like, this is what's going to happen.
That's great.
And I've just been on this mission for a minute. And, you know, I do work on behalf of many nonprofits, for myself, for the community. You know, what started off as just volunteering, doing stuff for free, has turned into contract work.
Mm-hmm.
I do education at workshops. And right now we're in the middle of tree planting season.
Mm-hmm.
This week on Friday, it's Georgia Arbor Day.
Oh, very nice. Okay.
We're planting an orchard.
Okay.
On Arabian Mountain.
Very nice.
And so, I think people just need to join a horticulturalist or an organization and learn how to do it properly. And I always like to tell people that you're not here today to plant X tree at X place. Like, what you're really doing is learning a life skill,
mm-hmm.
something that you can do over and over again. And to think about how a tree planting could be celebrated for a birthday or a baby being born.
That's great.
Or a memory of someone.
Yeah.
And to create a living legacy.
That's super inspirational.
Yeah.
I love that. That's awesome. And Chris, do you have any advice for young chefs or even home cooks that are interested in trying some new ingredients in the kitchen or expanding their palate? Like, what would you advise them to do?
Interestingly enough, I don't come from a professional kitchen background. I kind of come at this through a kind of, I don't know, back door of like just kind of getting into bakeries and like talking to farmers. Like I'm from a small town in upstate New York where it's mostly just buckwheat and dairy and mm-hmm. apples and grapes and the Finger Lakes. And so that's kind of my lens on food is like just this is what's around. Like we just have a lot of apples, so we have an apple-heavy cuisine, you know, or you know, just, you know, grain everywhere, so that whatever. And so, like, I would advise any young chef to, like, just go talk to someone who's been growing in your area for a long time, just ask them what they like to eat, because odds are, especially when it comes to heirlooms, there's a reason that people save seeds, and it's not always because they produce well. Oftentimes in the old days, it's because they just like the flavor of it. And
yeah.
They just kept planting it because they just like to eat it in their salad or, you know, for supper that night. And so I think that's the best advice you can give anybody is, like, just go talk to an old-timer and see what they like to eat, because oftentimes it'll be revealing as to what kind of flavors that they value. And then talk to actual, you know, folks like yourselves who, because it's this interesting conversation between these folks who kind of feel it in their bones of what grows here and the folks that study what grows here. And there's always this really interesting overlap.
Yeah.
Where you can get to, like, you kind of hear the gossip and the stories about it, and then you go to folks that really know kind of the specifics about it or have been saving the seed in a really, not thoughtful, but a very deliberate way.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time. And so, like, that's because this is a great windbreak or whatever it does for the community or for it feeds people or it's going to be. And so I encourage people to do that. And for home people, I don't know, just buy something you don't recognize at the farmer's market and ask the farmer what they use it for.
That's a great idea.
It's a great thing to do. It's like if you go to a farmer's market stall.
Talk to the farmers by chance. Yes.
As a person who stands behind a farmer's market table, there's not much to do except stand there and talk to people. It's kind of by design, right?
It's
like it is open to the public. It is free to enter. Like it is basically a big community meeting space. And so you are sometimes at the mercy of the public and sometimes you're just delighted to meet people that eat your food or just are living down the street from you and just use, you know, it's a meeting space that way. So like next time you're at a farmer's market, talk to the farmer or producer, whomever it may be, and ask them what they do with it. And you'll probably get a really good idea of something you didn't think of before because all they do is think about the stuff that's growing on their land.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, in addition to using serviceberry as a fresh fruit and in sauces and in these wonderful madeleines, you've also brought along a little treat for us, Ravi. I've got two beer bottles sitting in front of me on the table, and these are capped off in wax. And the label here is Conjuring Cultures, Atlanta Brew Company. And it says Brett Pale Ale with Mosaic and Service Berries. So this sounds amazing. Are we about to actually taste Service Berry beer?
Absolutely. And let me give a shout out to Gavin and all the wonderful people at Atlanta Brewing Company. Again, there's so many amazing people that share this ethos of using local seasonal produce. And when I have 140 pounds at a time, I can't take it to a bakery. I need to take it to a brewer.
Yeah.
And they're always requesting fruit.
Interesting. Fruit, yeah.
You know, those things that's needed to kind of create the balance and the taste. And so there's about 3 or 4 breweries I've worked with now over the years. And it's very exciting for me to see service berries in a beer.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
Those people are really those are like the unsung heroes of like the kind of local food movement, if you want to call it a movement. It's just the way of living, I guess. But like the unsung heroes are like of like local food infrastructure are actually breweries and distilleries because like A, people will always drink. B, they can buy a lot.
They can buy a lot, yeah, to support local foragers and growers.
Because like, you're absolutely right. People like me cannot take 140 pounds. I'd be up to my ears in service berries. But like the combination of these larger buyers and smaller buyers and boutique buyers like that like knits together this cool quilt of local infrastructure.
Yeah, actually, 140 pounds was only half the order because I had to come back to him like a week later because he's like, this isn't enough. I'm like, what do you mean?
Back out to the forest.
let's do a tasting.
Yeah, let's do it. So let's open these up. These look amazing. Wow. Is that wax? Was that right when I said that? Mm-hmm. That's so cool. Wow. Yeah, we'll have to get some pictures of this. This is great. Yeah, I'm loving all the, like, emerging brew culture in town. And, like, they have in March, they'll have the fermentation fest for more of, like, the veggie fermentation stuff. I'm going to miss it. I'm going to be in New York that weekend. But, think the best thing about this show is it's helped me connect with more chefs and foragers and fermenters. It's like my people. Thank you so much. All right. Awesome.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers. All right. So we've got this delicious serviceberry beer. And again, this was produced by which local company?
The Atlanta Brewing Company.
Atlanta Brewing Company. So cheers to the Atlanta Brewing Company for producing this amazing flavor.
Salute.
Oh, wow. That's really unique. Actually, as the chef in the room, would you like to describe the flavor profile?
Yeah. It's not as fruity as I thought it was going to be, interestingly enough. It's bright without being like overly juice, you know what I mean?
It's not sweet. I was expecting it to be sweet, and yeah. It's kind of got this nice sour, like mm-hmm. yummy sour element to it. I don't know.
That's what I'm picking up as well. What about you, Robbie? I taste serviceberry though. There is this slight tinge like in the back. I was like, that's great. That's
mm-hmm.
what I was kind of hoping for.
Yeah, for me, the service, the only thing I care about is serviceberry. So I'm like, yeah, it's there.
It's there. You can sense your berries there. That's great. That's great. I can smell it too. There's like a unique smell to the beer. That's nice. Mm.
Really good aroma. I mean, it's effervescent for sure. And it's just, it's really, really good.
Super delicious.
Mm-hmm. Super delicious. That's awesome. So,
what are good beer terms? Like we get like a cicerone to come and try some.
Yeah. So if I were to plant some of these service berries in my yard, how many trees would I need to adult trees could yield enough fruit to like do something with?
It all depends how much you want, but definitely plant a tree in your yard. The one thing that's to note about serviceberry and many of the native trees is they do tolerate some shade.
Okay, great.
However, if we're most interested in production and fruit, more sun, more fun, more fruit. So it could take full sun. It could also take some partial shade. It comes both in a multi-stem, kind of more bushy form, which I think is better for picking. It's a little lower.
Mm-hmm.
It also comes as a standard or single trunk, which is really great as a street tree, so the sidewalk
is free. Nice. I can imagine this would also be good in ice cream. Have you ever had serviceberry ice cream?
I have.
Oh, wow.
It's delicious.
Really cool.
Also, shout out to Terry, Chef Terry at the Wrecking Bar in Deer and Dove. But he preserves them and does a kind of like a buttermilk pie. And it's like with a serviceberry, like preserved drizzle with the berries. And it's like,
I feel like we should have a serviceberry festival in Atlanta. Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be so awesome. Yeah. After learning about it, I think they would. There's so many amazing ways to transform it.
There's people in town who use them for sure. I mean, Terry's a great example. Terry's an incredible local champion forever.
A lot of people have used them. I mean, the first year I was doing it, they didn't know what it was. And it was just so exciting to see everyone. I mean, I've never seen this happen where people would stop what they're doing, all crowd around the exec chef, and they're just like passing it out, tasting it. And then, of course, they say, well, we'll take everything you got. And it's exciting.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the show. This has been delightful, tasty, informative, all of the great things you look for in a food podcast. And I really appreciate it. And thank you for coming.
Thank you so
much. Thanks for having us.
I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. We've got a new website with some fun extra info for each episode to share with you, so check it out at www.foodiepharmacology.com. Also, be sure to never miss a future show. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud. You can also find us on many other podcasting platforms, including Podtail, Player FM, Listen Notes, Owltail, Pod Paradise, and more. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next time.